Have you ever wondered who Gimli's distant cousins are? Well, guess what? We're here today to answer that question. Welcome to another episode of Systematic Geekology. This is part of our Faces Behind Us series, where we talk about the characters who we love and the faces behind that inspire them, the family members, the people who inspired those heroes and villains that we love to follow and who are entertained by. And today we're going to talk about Lord of the Rings. We're going to talk about Durin and his family tree. And I have a couple of geekologists with me who are no strangers to systematic geekology. We have Trip Fuller, Dr. Fuller, who is of Homebrewed Christianity, a Patreon supporter, a fourth wall supporter of systematic geekology, Theology Beer Camp. He supporter and who leads and guides the Pop God stage and allows us systematic geekologists to hop on there and geek out on that stage. Trip,
I don't think I lead it, Will.
You don't lead it, but you definitely you wave your magic wand over and give us your blessings as we do. Okay. Yeah.
All right, I wave a magic wand at you.
You do.
You're like a Luvatar. You know, Will is like Aule. The stage is like the dwarves. Ooh. And you're a Luvatar who adopts the stage and makes all things, you know, happen.
That's right. That's right.
And if people aren't super familiar with Legendarium of Tolkien deep dives, they don't get how on topic
that's Nick right
Hulk of Tolkien Pop's jokes were there.
Which leads us to our next geekologist with us, Nick Polk, who is the wizard himself, former co-host here on System Geekology, who we bring on every now and then to enrich our Tolkien geekdom, and who lends his wisdom, his PhD of Tolkien, and has his own podcast and Substack with Tolkien Pop, and has done both Trip and Nick have done series and classes on Tolkien and Lord of the Rings. And I'm really excited about this particular episode for our supporters and those on Fourth Wall. This is going to be a lot of fun because as we think about our favorite characters in fandom and then what inspires them and then who they inspired, I have a couple people here who really inspire me when it comes to geeking out. So I'm really excited to.
Always good to see the Wilbo Baggins.
Always, yeah. Always. So as we jump on board here, as we do with Sys Mikey Gals, we talk about what we geek out on. Real quick, you know, some things we've been geeking out on. Trip, is there something other than Tolkien? Other things? What have you been geeking out on lately? I'm curious.
Oh, let's see. Elgin, my oldest, who's finishing high school, he's in the middle of Two Towers on his solo read and will give me conversations, you know, as he's going through it. So that's like the thing that gets me most excited. But like TV wise, I really like the new Percy Jackson season.
Nice.
I've read the most, I think I'm on the next to last book, reading them with my middle child, Cora. Mm-hmm. And Elgin just got into, he's watching Silo. The first two seasons.
Hell yeah.
He watched them, binge watched them, and is now in the middle of the second book in like the last 2 weeks. He read the first one and a half of the books, and I have never read the books. And he's telling me about it, but then he watched that, and I've been watching the, it's the fall, it's a post-apocalyptic TV show about a video game, Fallout.
Fallout rules, dude.
Fallout. Yeah, yeah. After the first two episodes, I was like, this is kind of cheesy. But once you get used to what it's doing, it turned out to be really good. And then the last two episodes of the first season, there are a lot of reveals. And so I'm digging it. And I watched Silo knowing what's going on and then to watch his reaction. And he's seen all of Fallout multiple times. And he's just like, looking at me, he's like, "What'd you think?" I was like, "Nah, they signaled that."
Yeah. Any of y'all watching Paradise? I've been watching Paradise on Hulu.
I saw the first season. I've heard the second season is just incredible.
Yeah, we're having fun with that. Really good stuff. Nick, what are you geeking out on, man?
So right now, it's kind of a video game right now. So I got rid of my Xbox. So my wife bought me a current gen Xbox for my birthday last year, and it was really cool, but Xbox has just sucked, and they're like, they've restructured their whole subscription thing. That's like, It's like, it's just taking money and it's to fuel AI generated games. And it's just doo doo. And so I was like, had the conversation with her, and I said, they're only getting away with all this shit because people keep paying for it. So I ended up selling it, and I got a PS2 and a couple other retro things. And so I've been replaying Lord of the Rings, the Third Age, which is the RPG game from like 20 years ago. And so I've just been going through playing this Lord of the Rings RPG game on PS2, and it rules.
Dude, you got to do Secret of Mana if you got PS2.
Dude, I've heard so many good things about Secret of Mana.
Oh, it's so good.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I'm putting it on my wish list now.
There you go. I'm geeking out. There's a new combo that came out called Lobo Number One. And Lobo is a DC character who, you know, I loved the Superman movie, and I loved that dog Crypto so much. And one of my favorite graphic novels.
Crypto?
I sure did.
Did he make you tear up?
I did. The last movie I cried in was a Superman movie because of Crypto. And I'm really excited about the new Supergirl Woman of Tomorrow movie coming out this summer, which is going to have Crypto and Puppy Crypto. Oh, and one of the greatest graphic novels I've ever read by Tom King and Evelyn Belqui. And in Supergirl, they're going to have Lobo as a character. He is a interstellar mercenary motorcycle dude who's going to be played by Jason Momoa. Yeah.
Really?
Right? Aquaman. Yeah. So Aquaman's going to be Lobo in the Supergirl movie. And so this new combo come out. One of my favorite creative teams, Scotty Young and George Corona, are putting out this comic. The story is okay. It's pretty funny, but the art that George Corona has put in there is why I read comics. And I know the only reason they put out this comic book is because they're trying to promote Lobo, who's going to be in the Supergirl movie. And then I went back and started watching Superman animated series when Lobo showed up in that. And there's like a two-part series of that animated series. And so even though Lobo's not one of my favorite characters, he's kind of like the Deadpool of the DC universe. It's been fun to kind of deep dive this in terms of what they're gearing up for this summer. And there's a ton of cool movies and comics that are coming out this summer to support those movies. And I'm pretty stoked on that. So go if you want to see like a masterclass in how you do art and sequential art with graphic novels, go buy Lobo Number One or pull it up on your DC app, and it's pretty rad. I'm pretty excited about that. Yeah, folks, hey, rate and review the show. We want to thank our supporters, those who are hanging out here, and Daniel Sigmund. Thanks, dude. Thanks for supporting the show.
Daniel's
an awesome guy. He's right down the road from me.
I just know he has great taste in podcasts that he supports.
100%, Daniel.
He sure does. 100%. And if you want a shout out, then you too can keep supporting, and we'll do that for you on the podcast. All right. So you've talked about we have this series, The Faces Behind Us. We have a playlist. You can see all the rest of the series we've done of the characters. We even talked about Michael Scott. We talked about others. Who's inspired our favorite characters, and who do they inspire? And today we're talking Lord of the Rings. We're talking Durin. Am I saying that right?
Durin. Oh, yeah.
I'm Durin. The Longbeards, the dwarves of Middle Earth. And so that's what we're going to talk about today. And so you guys' experience, if this is somebody's first experience with you guys, if you could, in 30 seconds to a minute, what is your experience with Lord of the Rings? Nick, like, you know.
Jeez. Have you read it before, or have you only watched the extended editions?
That's right.
It's editions only, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, okay.
You've only seen the cartoon?
Yeah, the Rankin and Bass one was all I needed, and then the weird Return of the King one, also Rankin and Bass, was all I needed. Ralph Bakshi, yep. Get the fuck out of here. So, no, I love the I actually love the Ralph Bakshi one. So 30 seconds. Grew up watching the Rankin Bass Hobbit. Didn't know it was connected to Lord of the Rings at all. Just thought it was a kid's movie. The Peter Jackson films came out. My family rented the first two movies and we saw the Return of the King in theaters as a family. And so then we just had it on repeat in our house, you know, basically like if we were bored, it was just kind of in the background. My dad would fall asleep to the Return of the King like every day. And then in college, I actually didn't even know about the extended editions until I started reading the books for the first time in college as a sophomore. And then found out there was this thing called the Silmarillion, found out there was a thing called the Tolkien Society, and then became a member of the Tolkien Society in 2015. And then just 2015 or 16, I can't remember, but it's just been downhill from there. Got involved with communities, watched the extended editions with friends, started talking to academics and started just getting involved in like Tolkien fandom and Tolkien scholarship. And then, you know, that's pretty much what led us together, I guess, too, through beer camp and all that and Tolkien fandom and shit.
And then at one beer camp, you led a Dungeons and Dragons, Lord of the Rings D&D game where I flipped off a bunch of orcs and then threw daggers at them and it stuck in the youth group wall.
We have a picture of Tom Webster.
The perfect place to do it this year.
What?
I'm just saying the D&D pregame.
Okay.
The location quality.
Ready. Quality.
Well, okay. I love that. Like Nick geeked out on the cartoons and the movies and then read the books and the source material and then got into the scholarship. And now he's a Tolkien scholar because of his fandom with all that. And now he's like the go-to person that we go to when we have questions about Lord of the Rings and the sacred texts of the Lord of the Rings. And, whether it's deep cuts or, legendary stuff, like Nick's the one that we go to, we talk about. And then Trip, I know your fandom is deep. I know at every beer camp when we have a panel and you literally make the room session. You make the room cry when you talk about the friendship between Sam and or you talk about these themes that are there that literally are homilies that move the room to tears. But I don't. When was the first time you read Lord of the Rings? Were introduced? Were you like, right. I don't know if I've heard that story of like okay, what was your first thing that you engaged with Lord of the Rings?
Middle school. I was at art school, right? Okay. So this is like a bunch of people into theater. So someone got The Hobbit and then they passed it around the friend group. This is right when Magic the Gathering came out.
The book,
yeah. The Hobbit. Okay. The book, The Hobbit. This is when the Magic the Gathering card game came out that we were playing at lunch. So Hobbit goes around. Then obviously you're like, give me some more. And then John got wild because you, when you're in middle school, you're like, man, there's a lot of poetry and descriptions of trees. And then, but I liked it. And then the movies come out and we're like in line to get tickets back when you had to do that. Yeah. And they were epic. And I've read the books a bunch of times. Always loved it and love it more. I think Lord of the Rings is my favorite book that was originally written in English. And I just find it ridiculous if people don't enjoy it. I judge them. I mean, not like exactly to their face, not as much as I judge Celtic fans or Duke fans, but close.
Now you're speaking my language, Trip.
Why? Why would you pull for Duke? Why would you not like Lord of the Rings? Everyone has growing edges. But like in particular, when
the Cobra Kai of college basketball is Duke.
When I think about the conversation today, which is fun because Durin, as you'll hear, is like obviously a character, but then it's one that shows up multiple times throughout all the ages of the story. And the role of the dwarves and how we understand them and read them is actually one of the places where the fact that there are a bunch of Tolkien nerds and you've continued to read the text, and then you start to understand where did the dwarves come from in Tolkien's own mind, right? How did it relate to the Norse imagery? How was it him reflecting on the unique covenantal situation of Israel? Then how did it develop over time as he expanded the legendarium backwards and forwards? And you get in this fun stuff. So everything that y'all know, if you're listening, is short of like going deep cuts into Tolkien. If it's just, you're just thinking Lord of the Rings and Silmarillion, all that is told by someone that's not a dwarf, right? Yeah. It's like, this is the elf shit. This is the elves that wrote this. Or the hobbits are telling this. And how many dwarves did the hobbits meet? Not very many. So one of the things you have about the dwarves is you always are hearing about them from someone else. Mm. Short of these few moments in The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings where you're actually hearing a dwarf talk about what it means to be a dwarf. So one of the coolest things about Tolkien scholarship that I know because Nick and his friends told me is like over time, it's like, well, we've learned that all these different religions, right? The most we knew about them for most of Western history is like Christian missionaries telling us how they found out cool ways to witness to them or like what's wrong with this or they're in a cult book or whatever. What happens when you actually like get to know what it's like to live inside that faith? Or live inside this other person's perspective. They all of a sudden there's a whole nother radiance and gift that's there. And the dwarves and their status in the legendarium is something that's become more beautiful over time because they are they native to Middle Earth or are they alien? Are they greedy or are they generous? You know, all of these like dynamics of like tensions that are sitting there get explored and they become one of the sites that some of these big themes of Tolkien, like the nature of hope in the face of loss and the long defeat, or the redemptive power of owning your place and cultivating a craft that cooperates with nature rather than coerces it. Things that sometimes you might look, oh, well, the hobbits do this good or they do this good. Those features become like definitional for the dwarves. And if you only know Lord of the Rings and stuff, you like the pioneering of friendship across difference that you see like, right, Gimli and Legolas also had these other moments in the story that that set it up, that, you know, where the gate comes from. I'm sure we'll get to all of it, but I'm just saying like the dwarves are fun, both in the origin of where they come from and how Tolkien is nuancing it. It's fascinating to see the role they play. They got a unique creation story. And then over time, all the scholarship starts to read it and go, oh, what if the only version we've heard it are people that know they're better than the dwarves? What would it be like to tell this story from the dwarves' perspective? And then they become even cooler. And then Amazon gave us during the third and during the fourth at the same time, which never happens in Legendarium. And you thought it was super sketch and you're like, why are you doing this? And then during the fourth says, give me the meat and give it to me raw. And then you said, I guess
it was worth it. It was worth
Bezos.
Thank you, Bezos.
Thank you, Bezos. It was all worth it. Yeah, yeah. That's really cool. Like I was a kid who didn't like reading growing up. I liked comic books and stuff from magazines, but then got into college and started reading a little bit more philosophy and theology and C.S. Lewis, and I read the Narnia books. And there was that one summer at summer camp when I was a camp counselor, and it was before internet and phones that could scroll and check social media. So I basically had all the Narnia books, The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. And that summer, when the kids went to bed, I was reading and blazing through those books, and it literally changed my life in terms of my love of reading and fantasy and fandom. And I've revisited it and following my two friends here, Tripp and Nick, and how they've unpacked it and brought it to a new level of depth for me in terms of how hermeneutic of how to understand the world and see the world through the lens of The Hobbit has been a gift to me over the last 5 years or so. And so to be able to talk about this now is pretty rad. And so today when we talk about, like, when I think of Lord of the Rings, you have all the cast of characters, you have the hobbits, you have the elves, you have the men, you have the dwarves, and they all come together for a specific purpose to defeat a power greater than themselves that they have to pull together as a team to defeat. And you have the legend, the myth of this ring. But, you know, what I love about this particular theme now, when we talk about the faces behind us, and we pick one particular family tree of Durin, family tree, and what that that lineage had an effect on the whole entire Middle Earth and every single person that you love, whether you read The Hobbit or just watched the movies. This family tree had a deep effect on how history played out for Lord of the Rings. So Nick, in terms of summing up here in a handful of minutes or so, Durin and his family tree, or how the dwarves were created from the Silmarillion, and how they were seen and viewed from others around, and then what this particular family tree had an effect on the Lord of the Rings. Where are their origins? Where they come from? How they emerge in this universe?
Yeah, this is like the when you talk to Tolkien nerds and they get to talk about the creation story of Tolkien's legendarium, which is called the Ina Lindale, like this is where people get they get excited. Like this is where you get people who can't you won't get them to shut up until they finish. But the
it's like asking a process person about Philippians to him. You know?
Yeah, when you kenosis, yeah.
You're just you want me to talk about kenosis?
Also a cool different language. The Ainu Lindale is a Quenya, I think, as well. It's the Elvish words and it means like the song of the Ainur. And so the reason for that is, so at the beginning, there's this monotheistic god, very similar to the god of classical tradition. And he calls forth beings, which are called Ainur, spiritual beings. And he calls them to participate in the creation of the universe through music. Participatory music. And so this happens. Okay. And there are two classes of Ainur, which were the spiritual beings. There are the Valar, which are like the lower G gods, if you will, if you want to call it that. And then there are the Maiar, which are the sort of angels. Gandalf is a Maiar, Sauron is a Maiar, or in the singular is Maia. Now the Valar are the lower G gods. And one of the most important, particularly when it comes to the dwarves, is the Vala Aule. And Aule is the Vala of like craft, earth, fire as well. Basically anything in a forge, that's who Aule is. And so Iluvatar, the monotheistic god of Tolkien's legendarium, tells everyone, hey, before you start creating stuff, you can't make anything, unless it's a world so that my children can live in it. And Iluvatar's children are both the elves as well as humans, called men with a capital M in Tolkien's legendarium. And Aule cannot help himself. He's like, dude, I can't wait for these children. I'm going to make my own. And Aule in secret makes the dwarves. And because Iluvatar is omniscient, he sees it and he shows up very similar to a sort of like a god showing up to Adam and Eve in the garden when they're hiding, and or also sort of coming to Abraham, you know, when he's about to sacrifice his son Isaac, sort of a deal. It's kind of a kind of similar vibes between both of them. So anyway, Aule is making these dwarves. They're seven. Durin is one of the original seven fathers of the dwarves. Okay. So, and I'll end it here, is that Iluvatar is like, Aule, I told you not to do that. I'm the only one who can create stuff. You can't give things their own individual life. They're basically puppets. And Aule's like, oh, you're right, Dad. I'm so sorry. And he goes to destroy the dwarves. And then Iluvatar is like, actually, because you were humble and repentant, I just gave them new life. They're my adopted children. But because you were naughty and didn't wait for me, the dwarves have to sleep until my children, the elves and men, show up first. So then the elves and men occupy Middle Earth, and then all of a sudden the dwarves stop popping up, and Durin's line is Durin and his people are one of the OG dwarven tribes, I guess, if you want to call it that, clan.
So are they looked down upon by men and elves as kind of like less of them because they were kind of out of sequence, or, you know, not at the right time or at the moment when they were meant to be? Is that some of the tension that's there between men and elves and dwarves, that they're seen as, well, you are, you know, not the bastard sons, but or like, you know, just somewhat off or not as special as others? Is that there? And
mostly with the elves. So men don't really even take dwarves into account, really. Basically, they're second class citizens or weird, mysterious creatures, and they don't really matter to men. So there's not a lot of hatred there. It's just kind of dismissal. But with elves, as soon as the elves saw the dwarves, they gave them, the dwarves, their own elvish name, and the elves called them the Nagrim, and that means the stunted people, which means the people who are short and should actually be tall. And so they're racist. The first
elves racist. Are super racist. Tall.
Yeah.
Like elves are taller in the books.
Yeah, we're talking like seven feet tall. Yeah, we're talking like insane.
Elves tall. Are tall.
And so they're the first name that elves give to dwarves is the stunted people. So, you know, at the first, there's tension there. Yeah. Superiority is real. Yeah. With elves in particular.
Elf supremacy.
Oh, yeah.
And the thing about this moment that you talked about, there's this kind of shame, right, with Ale of making the dwarves and then getting caught. Mm-hmm. When I read it last time, I read Silmarillion, I don't know, in the last year. And I actually thought it reminded me of after Cain kills Abel, right? Where there is a real violation. And God goes to Cain and is like, marks Cain and actually keeps him from dying, right? And was like, I'm going to end the cycle of violence. I want to. And so the adoption of the dwarves is a way of going like, I'm not just chucking this out. I'm actually reclaiming it. I'm adopting you to be part of creation. And the consequence of it is like you have to sleep. And then at the right time, I'm going to weave in this sub-creation that I didn't even ask for into the beautiful creation that I'm up to. Because, and this is one of the things you can, well, we'll let Nick explain this, but like Doran isn't just like a name that gets passed around. Doran is called Doran the Deathless, Doran the First. And then he kind of keeps showing up. And the seventh one is the last one who shows back up after the Age of Men for the eschatological banquet of sorts, like the ultimate eucatastrophe, right? And everything you think of that's in the stories, like is the first three ages. And then there's the Age of Men because it's all setting up for our world right now, right? But Doran the Seventh shows up the last, reclaims Moria. It's the final king of the line. And then what are these crafters' jobs ultimately to do is to bring about new creation. Like the from the very beginning, they're the children that are adopted. They play intricate roles that you don't know about. Like with everything in Lord of the Rings, where there's that big battle, they're actually having a whole nother battle with the Easterlings. And if they weren't doing this, no one would, like the Easterlings would have shown up. Everyone that's in the book would have got their butts kicked, but the dwarves were like holding rank, like little gangsters with their axes throwing down. So like there are all these ways that like, as you know more of their history, they're actually a thread that enables everything Eru Iluvatar, God's up to. And they're the chosen crafters to rebuild creation for new creation at the end. So like I say all that because sometimes people like always push back to a lot of the new readings of the dwarves that take place in Tolkien things. You're like, no, we want to get really hung up and emphasize things that make him seem anti-Semitic or anti this, or like, let's keep them bad, or always doing these tropes. And you're like, okay, I guess, except that Doran, the line of Doran's crescendo is like, we are the ones God has chose to be the crafters of new creation after the final battle. Like, come on, that's pretty hardcore.
Yeah.
And so anyway, so, but I think Nick has to explain how Doran works, because when you, the whole theme of like the faces behind us, Doran is the face behind and before us.
Yeah.
And it's,
because yeah, you have, we know Gimli and we, and who's a distant cousin. And then when he goes through the mines of Moria, right, that he's like, oh, he's awestruck about his lineage and some of these distant cousins and relatives. And he knows the lore there. And the Balrog is a part of that, history too, in terms of what emerges out of that too. But then you have Thorin Oakenshield, right? Who's in The Hobbit, who's a direct descendant, right? Of Durin. And so, we know them from The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, but like, as we get into like Rings of Power and some of the extended material and deep cuts in the literature, there is, yeah, explain, you know, how would this story be different without this character's influence? Like that's the thing. Like, remove this, the face behind us, like, remove these people. Are they the same people? So remove him from thing. You have a whole different story. You have a whole different saga. You have a whole different mythology there. So his impact on that is pretty important.
Sauron ultimately wins without the dwarves. That's the thing, right? Totally. Like, is the adopted children are ultimately required for the catastrophe of everything that the elves celebrate about themselves, and everything that, like, you think of Aragorn coming in, and that, like, the rival of men, all those things are only possible because of the dwarves, who weren't a part of the original song. It's like Eru Iluvatar may have, like, the ultimate ideals of beauty, truth, goodness, adventure, and zest, and yet, like, recognizes that the enactment of these eternal ideals actually requires the improvisational inclusion of things that are not of your own making, that God is ultimately like a master weaver, bringing in even rebellious initiations of alternative creations actually become a part of the whole story. The redemption of Middle Earth, or Arda, the earth, in it. But Nick, you need to explain how Durin works. This is like one of those things that, like,
yeah.
Cause in the book, this is what, like, if you're only reading Lord of the Rings,
yeah,
which is a great idea to do at least once a year. like, you get Gimli is sitting there in the halls of Khazad-dûm, and he brings up that little song, which I didn't know what the hell he was talking about when you're reading the book. Until you read Silmarillion, because he goes, this is Gimli talking about, you know, the story, like, in song. The world was young, the mountains green, no stain yet on the moon was seen, no words were laid on stream or stone when Durin woke and walked alone, because he was the first to rise, right? Like, the seven were there, everyone else is paired up except Durin the first. He's all riding solo. You got different little mountains where they're, I guess, like, chilling in their, like, sleeping dwarf vibe, and they're all paired off except for Durin, because he rolls deep. He's OG. And then in the song, Gimli says, "But still the sunken stars appear in dark and windless Miramir. There lies his crown in water deep till Durin wakes again from sleep." Right? And so you get in that story, right? And you remember he takes the hobbits down
to when see Durin's stone, yeah, in the Miramir. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, there is that one bit in the story where you get these hints. They're like, what's a Durin? And the elves don't know jack. That's how you figure out anything in Lord of the Rings, is you always hear the story from the perspective of the least informed. And they're like trying to explain to the hobbits, and you're like, oh, so it's like this king that's going to come again. And you're thinking, cause you've read the book before, oh, it's like the return of the king. No, it's even deeper than that.
Yeah. Ah,
so good.
Yeah, for those who want to know more about the dwarves, the most that Tolkien wrote about it, and it actually comes from Gimli's perspective, although it is written down by a hobbit, so it's secondhand information, is Appendix A in Return of the King. So Appendix A in Return of the King has an entire section called Durin's Folk. So if you want to know everything there is to know about Durin, that's available. For the most part, it's there in that line. So Durin is particularly the first that Tripp said is the Deathless. And the reason why he's called the Deathless is because people or the dwarves believed specifically, this isn't actually limited to Durin, though. All of the dwarves have their own certain clans. So there's the Firebeards, and I think they're associated with the realm of Belagos. And I can't remember what the other clan is called, but they're the other famous one is called Nargothrond. And so
Ironfoot.
And they're
the ones that show up in the extended edition of Hobbits.
Oh yeah.
And go crazy.
Yeah. Without Dane Ironfoot. Trip mentioned everyone would be screwed. But Durin, as well as all the other fathers of the dwarves, they believed that once the someone like Durin dies, eventually his body will come about again, and that his spirit will be revivified in this body. And usually this is through some sort of it's hereditary, I guess, to a certain extent, but not everyone who is born, who is a descendant of Durin, becomes a Durin. Okay. And we also literally
Durin the sixth, who gets killed by the Balrog.
Yeah. He's the last Durin. Yeah.
The first.
Yeah.
And so like it's not like Durin is always sequential or anything.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so there's spaces in between. Also, so there's theories about this, but it's either one reincarnation where Durin's spirit, because in Tolkien's Legendarium, there's a sort of dualism there. Spirits and bodies are separated and spirits leave bodies. And so people say that there's material that shows that Durin's spirit leaves and then enters the next body. And other people sort of say that he's just kind of revivified later. So his body actually didn't even die, really. It just kind of migrated to a certain extent. And so Durin, that's how Durin's line continues through those names. And then, of course, after the sixth, he dies. So Durin the sixth is the one who wakes up the Balrog. He is killed by the Balrog. Durin's Bane is the Balrog's name. It's in Lord of the Rings. And then that's when we start getting into the line of the two kind of sides, where we get Thorin's side and then Dane Ironfoot side as well. Yeah. And then Gimli comes from the Dane side, I believe. No, he doesn't.
But still, yeah. Longbeard.
He's still a Longbeard. Yep. Gimli is a descendant of the Longbeards and of Durin. Yeah.
And the thing about this is one of the unique things about the dwarves, because you have like the stability of the promise and past of Durin is like the elves, they crescendo early and are on the slow decline, right? And in the story of the ages, there's like this movement up of the role and vocation of the humans. The dwarves, because you have this kind of reincarnation, whatever you want to call it, have a rather stable kind of socio-political purpose. There's like they have a real vocation that's a part of the movement of Arda, Earth, this history. Very similar in style of like the Maya, like the wizards, there's a few of them. They play a very specific role and they can go off course, right? Like Saruman. But you know, he'll die and then he'll go back, get purified and whatever. Like Gandalf dies, comes back and now he's white. But the dwarves, they got like this ability of this like continuity that takes place in Durin. And it's also connected to their vocation. And that was something that like never made, like I didn't think anything about that till after like Nick brought all these Tolkien scholars on when we were doing these Tolkien head things. And then in the show Rings of Power, there's this like whole bit on like, why are there two Durins alive at the same time? And then he's like, there's a scene in the first season where you don't know Durin the third's really alive or not for a while.
And yeah, you guys were speculating that it was ghost.
Because we're trying to make sense of it. Because in the Legendarium, there's a sense that the reincarnated Durins have some kind of like incomplete memory of all the previous lives and the wisdom, and are like making, they're like the ability for like the revival of dwarves being dwarvish in the best way. Is that's what a Durin can do, right? Like when junk hits a fan, then you don't notice a Durin comes after it.
Avatar, right. The Last Airbender, the way that Aang, if anyone's familiar with that, the way that Aang is able to communicate kind of with the past avatars, I would say that's probably, it's very close to how Durin's, you know, reincarnation functions to a certain extent.
Nice pull.
Yeah.
That's a good pull. Yep.
Like, so in these moments, right, like if you think of Durin and the generations of Durin, you get like the OG and stuff. But then And from the very beginning, Casa Doom is like where they're rocking out.
Yeah.
Is Casa Doom the Mountains of Moria? Is that where the same thing
is? The Mines of Moria. Yep. The same thing.
Yeah.
Moria is a name that's given to it later by the elves. Moria means like the black pit. But before it had, I can't remember the other elvish name, but there was Casa Doom always from its beginning.
That's a rad name. Casa Doom.
Oh, yeah. And then
I'm going to name my next dog Casa Doom.
Oh, yeah. Casa Doom, Khaled Zaram. Come on now. Hell yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
So like in the show, if you're thinking of just a show, like it's all condensed of a larger period of time. But Durin the Third is the one that makes the alliance with the elves in Eregion, right? And they find Mithril. And obviously that's a game changer.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. The you get all the connection there, the dwarves and stuff, and that's where you get the big kind of potential for cooperation across difference that is obviously what's required later in the Third Age to really like get stuff to go down. And so you have this relationship where, I mean, the biggest reference I think for people that have watched the movie is like the whole door, right? Like speak friend and enter and stuff. During the reign of Durin the Third, Narvi, the guy that builds the door, he's like the master builder of the dwarves. And that's like peak dwarven engineering, that their craft is at like hardcore status. You know, Celebrimbor is like, man, those dwarves got it going on. Look at the way they're working this junk. And you get this like connection between the elves and the dwarves. And if you don't think about that, if you don't know like the whole history, and you only know this like bit of like gold lust in The Hobbit, like after the Arkenstone shows back up, you might go, oh, well, the dwarves are just like greedy isolationists and stuff like that. It's like such a rather narrow reading.
Right.
Because the dwarves not only had this partnership, right, that was sitting at the door, the elves are the ones that got suckered in by Sauron. They're the ones that are going to get wiped out. And then what does Durin the Fourth do? He rolls up, saves them at Eregion. He's the one that shows up and is like, Sauron's all like tricked them, being like, I'm bringing gifts. Not Sauron, I'm sexy. And then he shows up with the dwarves, and that's how you get the whole escape and the survival of some of the dwarves. They then go off and they establish, you know, like Elrond and company go establish their whole new home and everything, you know, that goes on in The Hobbit when you go to the last lonely home, Elrond and company to then, you know, Rivendell and stuff in Lord of the Rings. All that's only there because of the dwarves and elves friendship, and the dwarves were the ones that got suckered in by Sauron. And this is one of the other things that you don't, I will see how it does in the show. I'm sure they'll get this part right, or we'll rant about it for an hour and a half.
Right.
But the elves give Durin the ring, his ring,
well,
the Dwarvish ring that he gets.
Well,
right?
That's what he claims. So it's one of those things that the dwarves say, like, oh, we weren't corrupted. It was actually just us getting it from the elves. But it's probably more likely that Sauron actually corrupted them and gave them and tricked them.
So we'll find out which version they're going to do.
Yeah.
But you get this bit, right? Like in Durin the Third, that's like the relationship with the elves and all the stuff's going good. Narvi builds the door and stuff. And then Durin the Fourth is the one that comes in and saves it, that makes even the preservation of all those elves after the fight go down possible. And so like, just like in Lord of the Rings, there's another, like when we see, oh, this is the big battle, like, Aragorn and company are going to go run up to the Black Gate. Well, here's something else that's going on that you don't get till the appendices. Dane, who like when he was a kid, saw the Balrog, fought in the pits as a youth, ended his life as a king. He was king over 250 years and all up in the north, right? Like where Dale and company is that you see in The Hobbits. He's sitting there fighting next to the people in Dale. It's called the Battle of Dale later, and he is standing over the body of the fallen King of Dale, deep sacrificial loyalty, fighting to the end. And he's battling out. They're going to like get finally wiped. And then what happens? Why the dwarves show up and are tag teaming with the humans and Dale, fighting off the Easterlings and Sauron's army there. That's when Sauron falls, right? Like, so they like ran interference and are partnering with the humans there to save everybody. So like the whole story of the Durins includes multiple times Sauron wins unless they actually figured out how to be friends with the dwarves, right? And the only way you really know about it in the Lord of the Rings is the role of Gimli. And but so much of the other stuff is like the actual spirit of Durin running through the dwarves, despite the fact that they're, you know, the negative side of being a dwarf. Like, is it they'll show up, and if they, once they claim you as a friend, they'll be like Dane. They'll just be like slaying orcs and shit on top of the, like protecting the body of the king all the way down to the end. And I'm just like, dwarves are so much cooler than they get. Like, Gimli's not an exception. He's like what the line of Durin's like. And so like when he and Legolas become friends, hopefully they go to the Grey Havens together. Like, it makes perfect sense because that's actually how dwarves roll. And you just don't get to hear it much in the story.
Yeah. Right?
Like, you just, until you go deep, you don't get to hear it.
I think, you know, just taking it back to like Durin and why this is important and getting like Tripp's bringing it and spreading where the spirit of Durin is showing up throughout the history of Middle Earth. And so for those who don't know, like Tolkien's legendary is split up into three ages, first age, second age, third age. Oh, and a fourth age after the defeat of Sauron. But the dwarves are there from the very beginning. Okay. Right at the beginning of creation, essentially. And in the Silmarillion, there is partnerships between elves and dwarves, and collaboration. I mean, in the first age, right, that continues on to the second age, and then, of course, into the third age as with Gimli and the other in Dane's collaboration with Rivendell and Galadriel's army. But because all of Tolkien's characters are imperfect as well, and you don't, without the imperfections of these people, you don't get these awesome stories. And so the dwarves are an essential part to having the rings of power, to having awesome battles and also long lasting friendships. Yeah.
Okay. One other thing, Will. That Nick told me, and then when I went and read it, I got moved. Okay. So like the single most powerful act in Lord of the Rings is Bilbo freely giving up the ring.
Yeah.
He's the only person to do it. But what do you find out happens in 3018 TA? Messenger from Mordor shows up at Erebor offering to return the three missing dwarven rings of power and the realm of Moria to Durin's heir in exchange for, like, where's that thief that has the one ring? And Dane, Ironfoot, is just like, bump that.
He says, get you ye gone. Cloak.
Yeah, he just is like flips him the bird, you know, dwarf style, probably mooned him. But
flipped his beard.
But see, that in response to Sauron showing up and be like, do you want to get these other three rings? All you got to do is tell us where the thief is. And we'll clear things out. You can like even have your mountain back. You don't have to worry about no Balrog. We got this all under control. The response of the dwarf is like, not like, oh, reasonable, because we're greedy and we want our stuff. It's just like, bump you. And what is the response? What's Dane do? Says, Glon and Gimli, go to Rivendell. We need to tell Gandalf and Elrond what's going on. Right? So like think of the whole fellowship. None of that's possible unless Dane, Ironfoot, is just like, you're coming from that punk, Sauron. You're going to try to tempt me with these three rings. I'm going to say no to all three of them and go tell Elrond and Gandalf what's up. That's like Bilbo, like equivalent, right? Like, and you don't know any of that. And this is one of those bits because Gimli plays like the comic in the movie. You don't get that. Like, Gimli's coming from having like seen like a messenger of Sauron, you know, one of the seven showing up and stuff. And then being like, no, this is for real. Like he was well informed that junk's going down, showing up. And when he's saying yes to go to that and shows up right at the Mines of Moria, he knows that the King Dane had turned down getting it back from Sauron. That anyway, I just like, that's cool as hell.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Yeah.
You don't know how cool that is. And like, then later they have to, at the Battle of Del and everything, they have to stand up or they wouldn't have even won the battle. Like, dwarves way cooler than people know. Hmm. And Gimli is funny in the movies, but you don't get, like, he's there because he knows shit's going down. And then he's like looking at these other people that are like, well, what are we going to do with this? I don't know. We're going to take it to Tom Bombadil. Are we going to just walk into Mordor? Like, the elves are already understood, and they have already said no to getting their rings of power back.
And I think that's a perfect illustration of kind of the series of the faces behind us, is that not our own personal stories right now, Trips, Nick's, myself, is impacted. They're impacted by people who've come before us, and then what we do and our actions matter in terms of who come after us. And so this story of Lord of the Rings, you have the main players, you have that main alliance between this diversity of men, elves, dwarves, together, hobbits coming together for their specific mission and calling. But the what was going on behind the scenes and what's led them up to that point, and the people who have stood their ground or said no or rejected the rings of power or been tempted or rejected temptation before them, made a big difference in terms of how the story plays out. And so I think that's kind of what this whole series is been about, and why this is a perfect illustration of that. And so, you know, in terms of Durin and those in his line, like in terms of what are some traits there that we would want to imitate or not imitate in terms of like how we think about how we affect those in our lives, like in terms of, it's a deeper question that's beyond a couple of minutes, but we're going to keep going here for a little bit. But like, yeah, what are some traits here? I mean, Tripp just talked about in terms of like, yeah, hey, you know, here, you want the three rings back? And you're like, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to stand up and fight the good fight. But what are some traits there that we could imitate in how we do life and community and our alliances that we're a part of?
Man, there's two things I think of. One is the steadfastness of the dwarves. Like there are these elements of just like many of us, right? We are a little skeptical of risking revealing too much about ourselves with others in case someone betrays us, right? But the dwarves, once they risk themselves in friendship, their friendship is like one of the most fierce, most valuable things to have. I think Tolkien
talks about vulnerability, right?
Yeah.
Vulnerability that comes. Yeah.
And there's also the dwarves are actually very curious as well. So they put their partnerships with the elves lead to some of the most technologically advanced things and most beautiful things ever created in the legendarium. And so I think the steadfastness and curiosity is what I would want to emulate.
Yeah. How about you, Trip?
So, like, one of the scenes we hadn't talked about that you see in the extended editions of The Hobbit poorly. So Erebor, right? Like where they're all at, you get like the sacking of Erebor. And cause Smaug just comes in all nasty like, and then for like 20 years, the royal family, right, is living in poverty, moving around. They're like trying to piece together their junk, doing some crafting and stuff. And then Thor, who's now like the elderly heir of the king, got some psychological problems. Maybe the ring's doing some nasty stuff on him or whatever. He wanders back to Moria, and Azog the Defiler kills him, but doesn't just kill him. He desecrates his body, carves his name in dwarven runes on his forehead, and tosses the head to Thor's companion, Gnar, who with some coins and tells the quote beggar, here's a fee for you to go take this, you know, to the dwarves. Now the dwarves not been getting along for a while. When you or everyone's like trying to fend for themselves when they don't have like deep security and stuff. They're like a diaspora of people at this time. Well, Thrain the second after that, once they find out this junk went down, he tells all the dwarves. And then the dwarves are like, Azog did what? Yeah, carved that shit in runes on its head. And they holler out. So then the Iron Fist, Stiff Beards, everybody just like shows up. They're like, well, whatever. We're going to stop pissing on each other. This is no basket. Like, you dishonored the dwarves. Azog, are you ready for this? The dwarves go straight scorched earth. They go through and they just slaughter orcs. We're talking like going through the Misty Mountains bit by bit, just like laying waste. And this is one of those places where Tolkien gets uncomfortable with just how gangster the dwarves are, right? Like, you know, like it has to be pretty gangster for him to care how orcs are dying, right? This is one of Tolkien's growing edges, is to recognize that they do live and exist and have value. They're not just murder bots made of dirt. And he's like, you don't ever get him saying about any people. We're talking like, I don't remember, like, the Numenoreans when they're going bad and they did some crazy stuff, where he says they are completely pitiless and are committed to cruel deeds. And the dwarves, they're just like, no basket. Where we got our craft and our weapons, we're pissed off, and we're just going to go lay waste to the orcs. And they go.
Yeah.
And they go, like, multiple of the big characters die in the pursuit of Azog, but they get even. They get even. And the whole thing was driven by, like, this wasn't just like a battle over something or fighting for something. This was a straight defiling of Durin's line and everything that matters to us. You were just like pissing on that. And all the divisions and stuff they had, they were like, no. You've just like told us you suck in the most deeply dismissive way possible. And it was just like waking a dwarvish dragon. I was thinking of that. And I just personally think right now it would be really nice for people that think, isn't it cool that we have a legacy, perhaps like in one country on this world, that like we decided to have a multi-religious, multi-ethnic democracy, and that like there's just like a sheer honor that we get to decide and have wrestled with. And we've had all of our problems. Like, we had to figure out how to eventually let everybody vote and have a say. And we like, we had like a vision of who we were, and we had to grow into it. But then, like, somebody like grabs the figurehead of it, say the Constitution, and wipes their butt with it. And it's like, do I need to talk to the Congress to start a war? No.
Yeah.
Do I have a piece of thing that says you have to release all the Epstein files and not do it? Sure. Like, do I want to monetize the presidency with my family, where I'm really mad that the Biden family made $20 million, but I'm going to make $24,000 or whatever, and I'm going to make millions more, like 10x in for each family member of what the entire Biden family monetized the presidency for, like all that kind of stuff. And then, like, at some point you're just like, everything, all of our divisions are just ridiculous because somebody just like used our own language and inscribed it on the forehead of the Constitution and told us to go to hell. And then they were just like, No, like, we're freaking dwarves. Like, you don't get to do this. There's something essential to like being a dwarf that you've defiled Azog so much. And the only proper response is getting nasty. And not nasty for nothing.
Scorched Miller.
Because we want to still be here. And if we don't defend ourselves and eliminate this threat, then like, what's ultimately going to happen to the line of Dorne? And I used to be like, man, y'all overreacted. But, you know, hypothetically speaking, there could be analogies that make me think perhaps there's something that could erase longstanding divisions in a time of anxiety and scarcity to get you to unite for a beautiful dream that's yet to be actualized. And it doesn't get actualized till during the seventh. It's in the future. We haven't even got to the end of the fourth age yet.
You know, folks, listeners, patron supporters, fourth wall subscribers, that 5-minute homily is why we brought Tripp and Nick to this show and to talk about those things, the faces behind us. And what a gift. And you know, you think about like, The Hobbit's fun, you know. Hey, the Two Towers are fun when they're battling, and Gimli and Legolas are having their, you know, their little competition there of who could knock out more orcs than the other. But yet behind all that is this deep lore of this lineage that has an effect on the whole universe and the whole fandom of this story. And so that's why we do these kind of things. And there's so much more there that we'll keep doing. Man, Trip, Nick, thanks so much for doing this. We're gonna pause here. And so friends who are listening on Fourth Wall, those are our subscribers. We have a couple of questions here we're going to present that's going to hop on the main feed, that people are going to listen on the main feed, and they're going to want to come over here and subscribe and be a part of this and do that. So we have a couple of questions that we're going to talk about a little bit. And this was presented by Nick. And I was like, what's a bonus question, extra question we could do with this? And these are here. One, do dwarves, elves, and men go to the same afterlife realm, or do they go to different separate realms, or are they the same? I have some thoughts on that. I bet Trip does too. And then another one, what happened to the dwarves after the Lord of the Rings? Those are two questions we're going to talk about.
I want to give you my third, though.
Your third?
You got to go to any of the dwarvish kingdoms at any particular time. Which one are you going to?
Ooh, yeah, okay. Yeah.
Okay, three questions, friends. There you go. Boom. We're going to keep going here. So hop on over. We are super appreciative for you all, and really thankful to our supporters and listeners and geeking out with you. I share with my friends here that I have a sabbatical coming up this summer, and I'm going to reread Lord of the Rings all the way through. And I can't wait when I come across a particular sentence or a name or something. I can't wait to reach out to both of these and ask some questions. And let us know what you guys think, and keep going deeper with all of this. And I see messages here. Keep talking. Thanks, y'all. Peace out.
They should come hang out with us at Theology Beer Camp.
They should.
Yes. And
there'll probably be a panel. There'll probably be some talk and talk. There might be some Narnia talk. There might be a D&D session. Come hang out.
Probably a panel on Tolkien. I would quit my own event if you don't have a Tolkien panel.
It's got to happen. And
Craig are both coming this year, so.
It's going to happen. It's going to happen.
I believe last year, somehow in the middle of the session, we discussed how about Gandalf beating up Peter Thiel.
That's where one of my favorite somewhere. One of my favorite things, and I wish I was there live to have heard it.
Mm-hmm. Hey y'all, this is Will Baggins. The Geek in Me honors the geek in you. Flip back around. We'll see you next time. Peace out, y'all.